Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of Fish Bites, Miami Herald's Miami Marlins podcast. I'm Jordan McPherson. He's Andre Fernandez. How are you doing, Dre?
I am good, my friend. We're at that point now where baseball season is roughly two months left in the regular season. Unfortunately for this team that we podcast about, it's there's some things to watch, not what the ideal fan wanted to be watching at this point, but at the very least, you're seeing the wave of some of these prospects making their debuts now these last few weeks, and a few guys that, you know, were kind of under the radar that have also emerged. You know, you're writing a Charles LeBlanc feature for me, today, and you know that you've got, you know, JJ Bleday's first few weeks in the majors, and who knows, maybe a Gerard Encarnacion sighting down the road to come back too. Who knows?
And you completely forget about Peyton Burdick in his first home run.
Peyton Burdick, yeah, of course. I didn't want to like drag it on here because we're going to get into different guys. But yeah, Peyton Burdick, first home run. You know, moments that you're seeing now, the future guys you hope for are getting their chances, and that's what it's going to be about for these last 2 months. So on that part of it, it's interesting. On the overall side, being double digits under 500 and out of it at this point was not what they were planning. And again, the big picture, big setback with the leap that wasn't to be for this franchise this year.
Yeah, as Dre mentioned, Marlins are 49-59 at time of the recording. Marlins have an off day today before starting a 3-game series with the Philadelphia Phillies at Citizens Bank Park. Interestingly enough, I'm in Philly already. I've been here for about 6 hours and have not had a cheesesteak yet, which I'm disappointed in myself.
What's wrong with you?
Yeah. Again, just
wait. They can make a coffee run. You can't make a cheesesteak run. This isn't right.
I can make a cheesesteak run. I just, for some reason, have not. I don't know why I have not, but I will be making several cheesesteak runs while I'm here through Thursday. So,
all right. Well done.
But on that note, again, with the season where it is, with the record where it is, and with a little time left, really not going to be talking much in-game details. It's going to be podcast this week and most likely the rest of the way. Going to be highlighting individual performances, individual topics that are of substance for what happens the rest of the way and will be of pertinence moving on down the road. Before we hop into all that, just need to quickly rehash the trade deadline because our last podcast was the pre-trade deadline podcast. So now let's talk about what they did, or rather what they didn't do at the deadline. The Marlins only made one move. They traded a pair of relievers, Zach Pop and Anthony Bass, to the Toronto Blue Jays for shortstop / third baseman prospect Jordan Groshans. I'm 90% sure I got the pronunciation of his last name right. But anyway, he's guy who's up in AAA, was the Blue Jays' first-round pick in 2018, the 12th overall pick, the pick right before the Marlins when they picked Connor Scott. And the Marlins said that Groshans was a guy who was on their radar back then. Not really a power guy, line drive, gap-to-gap guy. Had a relatively down year by the time he got traded to the Marlins, only hitting about .250 in AAA. 22-year-old, so he is a little bit on the younger side for AAA. But the main purpose for getting a guy like him was flipping from the area of quote-unquote strength that the Marlins had, which was having a lot of bullpen arms, knowing a couple guys were coming back, for a guy who gives them upper-level infield depth in the system, which when you look at the Marlins, where they are in terms of the organizational depth, all of their top hitters, from including Bleday, Burdick, who made their debuts, all of their main hitting prospect talent at AAA were outfielders. So to be able to get a guy like Groshans, whether he pans out or not, to have a guy who was a top 100 prospect to be in your system at AAA and make it so that you don't have to rush, say, the Nesin Nunez's and the Jose Devers's, who are in AA right now, if something happens, it gives you that little bit of that buffer. It gives you a guy who's close to being ready and gives you just that organizational layer that they didn't have in the system. And it also starts prepping them for what could happen a couple years down the road. Miguel Rojas is signed through next year. Joey Wendell only has one more year on his deal after this year, or one more year of team control, I should say. So it at least gives you an internal option as a fallback in case something happens to either Rojas or Wendell down the road, or if they don't make a move with replacing either of those guys, if they don't choose to keep them after next season.
Plus, it takes the pressure off Holloway being the only, not being the only other Jordan on the team, right?
That is very true.
Yeah, the lost Yamamoto.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, he won you over.
It gives me some competition in the Jordan front too. So I'll take that.
I was gonna say he won you over just for on the first name alone. That trade won you over. But no. But in all seriousness, yeah, that it's a move. Yes, is it a sexy oh my god move? No, of course. But it's one that fits in a lot of ways of what you're saying right there, because this infield's going to be in flux for pretty soon. I mean, aside from Jazz being where he's supposed to be once he gets his back healthy. Yeah, I mean, you look at this team right now, middle infield, yeah, Rojas, we don't know where Mickey's going to be down the road. You know, I mean, I think overall in that infield, you know, Joey Wendell has been great. Is he everyday guy, though? Not ideally. You do want him to be in that mix where he can switch around with other guys. Brian Anderson's had his injury issues. You know, he's not signed long-term, so what's going to happen at third base? So there's a lot of – so it's good to have that extra layer there for sure. And, yeah, with those other guys that you talked about not being completely ready to go from the minors, you avoid that having to push too hard and maybe, you know, not properly handle their development, especially guys that you're now maybe starting to see a little more strides when it comes to their bat, like a Nassim Nunez, you know, that's not, we're not thinking of him being an offensive powerhouse type of guy, but he has made strides. But you need a guy like that to gradually get there and progress. And this allows you to. So in that sense, it was a good move. In the grand scheme of things, maybe the move that everybody wanted, that maybe everybody was thinking they were going to see, didn't happen, which was the Pablo move. But you know, you have him now, at least for next year, and now it becomes interesting. Do they ship him off in the offseason with a similar deal? Maybe not the Yankees, maybe someone else. Or does this mean maybe you hang on to him a little longer? Still an arbitration guy, so we'll see. I mean, looking at that deal, the proposed trade that Barry and Craig reported, I mean, could have happened, or at least was being talked about. I don't know. I don't know how much bringing Gleyber Torres here, paying him more money, maybe him not hitting. I mean, he's not tearing the cover off the ball for the Yankees this year, but maybe you're paying a more expensive guy to maybe not do what he does on the AL side. I don't know. I don't know if that would have been worth it, losing the arm like Pablo. And then even on their side, you know, it was kind of a big ask to think the Yankees were going to hand over a major prospect like an Anthony Volpe. So, I mean, if they had, it would have been a great get for the Marlins, obviously, but they didn't want to do it. So that to me was interesting that kind of that permutation was kind of being floated around, but maybe for the best for both sides.
Yeah, definitely. And on that Pablo front, the Marlins are gambling on themselves with it. I mean, obviously the move, unless they got the offer they wanted, there was no need or pressure to trade Pablo Lopez at the deadline, because he's under team control for two more years. The main thing now is if he's able to finish the season, which is a big ask considering the fact that he's three starts into the second half of the season, is already the farthest he's pitched into a second half of the season without an injury. He's already at his career highs in innings pitched, career high in games started, career high in strikeouts. If he's able to find a way to get through the final 2 months without a significant drop off, if he's able to hold steady, maybe even if there is a tick back in production as he gets into his uncharted territory, if he's able to stay through the season, come December, once winter meetings roll around, still has 2 years of team control. The value should theoretically tick up a little bit if he can show he can finish a full season. And that bodes in the Marlins' favor if that's able to happen. But again, on the flip side, if he turns into the Pablo that we've seen before, where the shoulder starts acting up again, it just continues to raise that one flag of, is he durable enough to merit a contender reaching out and trying to get him for a postseason push if he's not able to get to the postseason? So it's the balance there, but also at the very least, the Marlins get to see through the duration of the season, they have the rotation intact. I mean, Sandy and Pablo are the 1-2 punch. Jesus Luzardo's looked great in his two starts back. His latest one on Sunday, 7 shutout innings, only one hit and one walk. I had a no-hitter going in through, I think it was into the fifth. Edward Cabrera had 5 no-hit innings in his first start back. So you look at Sandy, Pablo, Luzardo, Cabrera, even with Trevor Rogers going through his lumps, he's on the IL right now. He starts a rehab assignment on Tuesday. Still have those 4 guys, plus Braxton Garrett, who's made strides this year. So, and it's just a matter of finally seeing this young rotation, which has been the backbone of the rebuild. If they're able to keep that core together, or at least show that they're able to have, they still have that intact, at least have part of the equation, even if it's not with that permutation that we saw at the beginning of the year, and you're able to see some of the other arms and the other options, which if all these guys pan out, it makes it a little bit easier if they end up moving on from Pablo to show that they still have the other options.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. How much depth do they still have pitching wise overall, not just at the major league level, but even in the minors? We've seen some changes to that, you know, guy through, whether it's through injuries or guys that you're expecting to do well that have regressed a little bit or have had some issues like a Trevor. I mean, if they could find a way when Trevor gets healthy to fix his issues, that's only a plus going in the next season. Whether he comes back at the end of this year or he just fixes everything and comes back kind of like the guy he was next year, obviously that'd be huge, especially if you do deal Pablo to someone else. For Pablo himself, starting with him, you want to see that for himself to finish the year strong for his own career. Hasn't been able to do that. This could take him to another higher level as a pitcher, whether he stays here or whether he goes somewhere else, just to have that, to be able to say, okay, I got through a year, I pitched whatever it ends up being, 150, 160, whatever amount of innings, and I'm fine. My arm isn't messed up going into the offseason. I don't have to worry about rehabbing this, that, you know, because the shoulder can give you issues ongoing throughout a career once you've had them. So this would be big for him, no doubt about it. But think about it. Then you have, if you can go in the next season with the vision of having, let's say, Sandy, him, Cabrera, if you could somehow fix Trevor, that's already four. And then if Luzardo continues to do, because he did really well against Chicago, if he could bottle that, he's had a few starts like that this year. So there is stuff to work with there, unlike last year before where he was struggling big time. Now he at least has shown those flashes. You have, at least in theory, like a working five with a couple other fringe pieces to kind of think about. And then that kind of gets you a little further while you're waiting for, you know, Eury Pérez to be ready to go down the road in about a year or so, something like that, you know. So that's where, again, that pitching depth gets better, and you can turn your attention back to trying to pad the hitters, which still is like the big problem overall in the organization, is finding, you know, even if it's not another Jazz, but finding guys that are talented, impactful hitters that can do damage.
Yeah, and Marlins are trying to see what they have with some of those young hitters right now. As you mentioned at the top of the episode, just the guys who have made their debuts, been called up, J.J. Bleday a couple weeks back, Charles LeBlanc, Peyton Burdick over the last week, Lewin Diaz finally getting some opportunity, and yeah. I'm also very interested to see how, since the Marlins didn't trade Gerrit Cooper or Jesus Aguilar, the fact that you have all three of those guys up here right now, and the matter of how you split the time between, you want to see what you have from Lewin, who is, I don't even think there is an argument, he is the best defensive first baseman out of those three, but also knowing that you have the financial obligations of the Aguilar and Coopers.
Yeah.
And the interesting part about it is, I asked Kim Ng about that right after the deadline, what the plan is moving forward with those three. Her response was, I need to talk with Donnie about that. We need to figure it out. Fast forward a couple of days, I asked Don Mattingly about it, and he goes, I still need to figure out with Kim what they want to do with this. So it's just a matter of,
you're being deflected, my friend. That's all smokescreen.
Yeah. Nope, it's the double deflection, and it's, again, they've rotated all three of them so far throughout this week since the deadline. Now that Cooper got activated from the IL on Wednesday, and it's going to be interesting to see, like I said, how they split over the last 2 months, since Lewin feels like the only one who's guaranteed to be part of this beyond the end of the season.
Yeah.
So
they're the kids.
Yeah.
I think they have to play the kids. I get it. Contractually, it's not that easy to say. But if you're going to err on the side of who gets the highest percentage of that, let Lewin be that guy that gets the highest percentage of however split you work out between the three. I mean, the DH, obviously, right? I mean, one of them can be, one of the other two can be, you know, platoon the DH and have Lewin playing first for the most part. You know, I mean, you're not going to be able to do that every single day, but for the most part, get the kid his swings, get the kid his reps at first. He is smooth there at first base.
He's fun to watch.
Definitely. Exactly. I mean, night and day compared to the others, to be honest, on the defensive end. So he needs to get as many at bats as possible the rest of this season, like the other young guys, because that's what's left. That's what's left. You gotta make sure those guys are as developed and ready to go going into 2023 to make another run at this.
Yeah, and the other two main young guys, Peyton Berg and JJ Bleday, they're getting everyday playing time right now, and they have injuries to credit for. I mean, Jorge Soler's on the IL with back spasms, with Don Mattingly, after when Soler was initially put on the IL, wasn't really given the timetable. And then on Tuesday, Donnie said, yeah, this is something that's going to be long-term. So it's looking like Soler, who knows when we see him again. And then Oxel Garcia went on the IL with a hamstring injury. So with the fact that those two guys are on the IL and that they optioned Jesus Sanchez to AAA, which I'll get into him in a second, it frees up JJ to get the bulk of the reps at center field, Peyton to be able to play either of the corners, De La Cruz gets the other spot. So you're getting to see the three main young guys who are here getting the outfield reps. Burdick started all three games in Chicago. He went, I think it was 2-for-9, but it was, 2-for-9 with the home run. He drew two walks. He struck out 5 times, but if I remember correctly, 2 or 3 of those strikeout ABs were 5, 6, 7, 8 pitches. So he's getting the lengthy at-bats, even though the results weren't there, and finally was able to drop a single into left field in his second game on Saturday, and then had no doubt of a home run on Sunday. And then JJ Bleday, I need to actually pull up his numbers, but they're giving him as much run as possible in center field, and he's looked smooth defensively, which to me was the biggest question. We knew that he's productive with his at-bats. He has the approach. But to see that he's comfortably playing well in center field and was doing that at a ballpark like Lone Depot Park, to me that was a big plus to see, because otherwise he would have been having to ride the Jesus Sanchez, Brian De La Cruz platoon out there, which we saw how that had been working.
Yeah. Look, De La Cruz is kind of, you know, similar to Birdie. He's like your utility guy out there. I think he's a solid outfielder. But again, it goes back to, you know, playing the kids. These off-season outfielder moves have been a fail, whether poor performance or injury. You know, you peg the reason however you want, but the bottom line is they were a fail overall, you know, and you have to regroup from that. And the way you do that right now is by playing, like you said, by playing Bleday, by giving him as many at-bats as possible, give Burdick as many at-bats as possible. If Girard comes up soon, same thing. Whoever you can, that's part of the future of this team, to get going over these last, you know, close to 2 months, whatever's left, you know, and then you reevaluate. You get into the off season, you know, winter meetings and such. You see what you can. Maybe, you know, that's when the buzz is going to begin again about, you know, teams are going to knock and check in on Pablo and whoever else. You see what you got. You see what you got there in terms of what you can add to this team, because, you know, but again, it's hard not to deviate and think, you know, here we go again. Here it is on repeat again. But, you know, but focusing on that, it's all you can do. It's all you can do as a franchise at this point, you know, barring any, the rest of this season is also going to be interesting in terms of personnel, because like we've talked about, you know, who's the manager of this team next year?
Yep.
You know, that's the other big question. Does Don come back? I mean, and that's a team thing. Does the team bring him back, because his contract's running out, if I'm not mistaken.
This is the last year of his deal. So it's,
yeah, I mean, I know he says, I don't know how I'm going to feel. That's great. But, you know, it's also up to the team.
Yeah. That's if kind of it's putting the cart before the horse.
Exactly. Yeah. And you do it with respect. He's done, considering all the challenges, let's just put it, hats off to what he's been able to do, and how, more than anything, how he's always a class act with everything and everyone. But a decision has to be made, you know, and this is where, going back to the project we did, you and I did back in, toward the start of the season, mm-hmm. we're already past that point where most, at least successful rebuilds, flip and go to that one manager that gets them over the top. Rarely did we said how they're one of the few times we've seen where a guy sticks past year four, year five, that went through the rebuild process. So is this the point where they move on from him? And who is that guy? Is he already here? If it's James Rosen, or is it someone that they go out and get and entrust with, can you take us over that next hill toward maybe becoming a true playoff contender? You know, we'll see. That's going to be one of the most interesting topics to follow.
Yep. And it's just with where we're on season, it's going to come sooner than later. I mean, still hard to believe it's already August.
Yeah. I mean, there are going to drag. Yep. There's going to be, and they're already happening. We've seen some of these games where it's like, ooh. Yep. And especially some of these scoreless droughts they get on. Yep. But that's a byproduct.
Just reminded myself that Saturday's doubleheader at home.
By design. The design doubleheader
is because of that late schedule, yeah.
Yep.
So, and it's interesting because, again, I think it's actually the first time I cover a split doubleheader where it's the 1 o'clock, 7 o'clock. Yeah. Oof. So.
That's where you wish you could go and grab a bite and come back to the ballpark later kind of thing, mm-hmm. but a little too complicated in that.
Yeah, but my reward for that reward, I guess, is the way you can say it, is that's the last game I cover on that homestand. I'm only doing Friday, Saturday this week.
Yeah, that's right, because somebody else is doing the Sunday game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, wonder who that person could be.
Yeah, I know. I wonder who. But I'm glad I'm doing the Padres game the week after. That ought to be fun. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yep.
It's Juan gonna Soto.
Be, yep. Gets, yep. He returns about a month earlier than he was supposed to. It would have either been then or when the Nationals came in September, which, again, how about that trade, man? I mean, you look at, with Tatis coming back on a rehab assignment now, when you look at what that lineup's going to be, him, Machado, Bell, Soto, they locked up Musgrove.
They don't beat LA now. They never will. Nope. Yeah, but, and the road in the and the road out there still goes through LA. I mean, yep. AL, obviously the Astros still strong. The Yankees are doing what they're doing, but their nemesis is right in their backyard, right there. So
yep, it's Dodgers and then the Yankees that now, or the Mets. Sorry, wow, wrong New York team. The Mets now they finally have both Scherzer and DeGrom back.
Yeah, they're still in a confined small window, like a playoff series. You can't discount how dangerous they're going to be. And I'll admit when I'm off. It's starting to look like they may actually win this division. And I've been one of the haters on that. I've been one of the doubters, thinking Atlanta's going to take over. Atlanta's going to take over. They got close. They pulled away in a game and a half. And to the Mets' credit, the big stiff arm.
Yeah, this past weekend. Yeah, this series. Weekend. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, hey, tip of the cap. They actually are proving that they're not the same old dysfunctional Mets there's still 2 months left, but – the signs are, and they have collapsed. I mean, the Marlins themselves kicked them out 1 year. Remember when they blew a 7-game lead in like the last 3 weeks of the season? But barring that catastrophe from repeating itself, they are showing signs of truly being a legit playoff team and a legit division title winner if they can hang on. And yeah, with those two up at the top of the rotation, if they're healthy, dangerous playoff team.
No doubt about it. And I think that's going to do it for us this week. Thanks so much for tuning in to this week's episode of Fish Bites, everyone. I'm Jordan. He's Andre. We will be back again next week.